Welcome to Beyond the Matrix with Rod Bryant and Jerry Gordon here on Israel News Talk Radio. Unplug, strap yourself in, because you are about to move beyond the Matrix.
What a great day to move beyond the Matrix and give you some information that is vital for your decision-making process and to keep informed of what's going on about Israel and the Middle East. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio, sponsored by TorahLearningChannel.com, one of the greatest resources that you can find. Some of the best Torah teachers in the world in English, all in one place. Jerry, we have an amazing guest. First time ever to have Dilmun Abdul-Kadir on. And this is a young man full of fire for the country that he came from and also his people, the Kurds. So, Jerry, why don't you pick it up and kind of give us a bio of our guest?
Well, Dilmun is most unusual. He is essentially was born just about the time that you served in the first Gulf War.
Same age as my son.
And he fled along with his family from Iraq and Iraqi Kurdistan to essentially sit 7 years in a UN
refugee camp
in Syria and learned how bad that was for the Kurds. And subsequently, the family was admitted into the United States. He's got an American citizenship, and he's well-educated. He's got a master's in international service from American University in D.C., but he's unusual. He's the first Kurdish-American advocate for his own people going to Capitol Hill to get the message of why the Kurds are Americans' most important ally in the Middle East, beside Israel.
And what I really like is he's part of an organization called the Endowment for Middle East Truth Kurdistan Project. The acronym is EMET, which all of our Hebrew speakers know that it means truth, and that is not an accident. Actually, Sarah, who has been one of the key figures in the organization, came up with that acronym. We're going to find out what the truth is about the Kurdish region, about the Syrian Democratic Forces, et cetera, here on Israel News Talk Radio's Beyond the Matrix. Don't go anywhere. Stick around. You're not going to want to miss this show. As a matter of fact, I encourage you to share it with your friends. So we'll be right back after these very short messages. Thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate you guys listening each week. Want to remind you that the Matrix is sponsored by Torah Learning Channel. It's found on the internet, TorahLearningChannel.com. It is our exclusive supporter, and we really appreciate you guys taking time to check it out. You don't want to miss it. 24 hours a day, 6 days a week, some of the best English Torah teachers in the world are on that one location. Jerry, we have a very distinguished guest, Dilmun Abdul-Kadir, and Abdul-Kadir, and we really appreciate you taking time. I know that it's coming on. We had some technical difficulties getting everything straight, but really appreciate your patience in the whole process. So we really want to thank you for coming on to the show. First of all, let's ask, what is your role in the Endowment for the Middle East Truth Kurdistan Project?
Thank you to both of you, first of all, for inviting me on this to discuss these critical issues. My role at the Endowment for Middle East Truth is director of the Kurdistan Project. My core issues is the Kurdish issues. So it's not specifically Iraqi Kurdistan or, say, Kurds in Syria, but it's Kurds as a whole, spanning all four regions of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. And what I try to do is to educate lawmakers and their staff on the Kurdish issues, the Kurdish plight, human rights issues, and developments on the ground. And we try to do this as best as we can. And I think we have seen a little bit of improvement.
When you say improvement, you're talking about the openness for politicians to have a dialogue about Kurds? period?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. They're much more aware on the Kurdish issues now than they were, say, 2 years ago,
wow.
for example.
Okay, good.
So, and they don't see Kurds as Iraqi Kurds specifically, because that was the old idea, only Iraqi Kurds, because that's what we were used to. But now they are much aware of what's going on in Turkey and Iran and, of course, Syria today.
Okay, good.
Dylan, now, tell us about your background as a Kurd born in Kirkuk, and who came to the U.S. as a refugee.
Yeah, definitely. So I was born in Kirkuk during in the beginning of the first Gulf War. I was just an infant, and my family and I fled Iraqi Kurdistan early 90s, and then fled to Syria, which is under the control of the Syrian Kurds now, under the Syrian Democratic Forces. At a United Nations refugee camp. Actually, it's called Al-Hol Camp. And that camp was actually targeted by ISIS in, I believe it was 2014, 2015. We ended up being at the camp for 7 years. I was young, but I still remember to this day. I remember living under Hafez Assad, his father, his father's dictatorship. And, you know, that's why it's so critical today that we have to not allowed to legitimize this regime. And then, you know, we stayed there for 7 years, ended up coming to the United States early 98, I believe.
What is the rationale behind President Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. forces from Israel? Because this actually came sort of a surprise to Jerry as well. About Syria, yes.
So President Trump, obviously, he wants troops out in the Middle East or in many of these long conflicts, for example, Iraq and Afghanistan is another. He did warn policymakers and his generals back in April 2018, correct. March, late March, early April 2018. And then he got basically he was pressured to keep his troops in there for another 6 months. He gave them 6 months, and it was a simple follow up, I think. We were warned that he was going to withdraw. Of course, it's not the wisest decision. We don't agree with that decision to withdraw troops from Syria. It just doesn't make sense. We saw what happened in 2011 under the previous administration, mm-hmm. under Barack Obama in Iraq. The Kurds even warned the Americans to not withdraw the Iraqi Kurds. And then a few years later, what happened was the rise of ISIS.
I think that on the whole, I understand the president's rationale, right? It'd be nice to be able to say that we don't have to be involved in any more conflicts around the globe. But at the same time, the Kurds have been an amazing partner for many, many decades. And I guess that was a surprise for me because I thought, wow, I thought the Kurds would at least be preserved or there'd be a secondary plan. But sometime about last year, Jerry and I had gotten some information from someone on the ground that said there's no plan for a Kurdish, controlled region or government, et cetera, et cetera. And I became a bit dismayed because we have been such strong opponents for Kurds, period. So was the president's, announcement just premature, or do you think this was strategic at some level?
I think it was premature.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the Kurds acknowledge and realize that the United States or any – this is not towards President Trump at all. Any U.S. administration does not have the appetite to create a Kurdish state. What that means is basically the breaking down of the status quo, mm-hmm. of the state of Iraq, of Syria. Can you do that? Can you harm your NATO ally, Turkey, for example? Is Iran ready for regime change? And because all of these countries have large Kurdish populations in the millions, and NATO partner Turkey has 20 million Kurds alone. So the president's decision to withdraw, I think, was he wants to withdraw. We know that, but was it thought about? I don't think so. Was it thought through? I don't think so. Did he think about the Kurds? I don't think so, unfortunately. But you know, the Kurds do rely and need the Americans on the ground.
Let me ask you, what is the danger of helping to establish a Kurdish government and a region that has their own control? I mean, what do you think the disturbance in the status quo would bring?
The danger is, from a Kurdish perspective, it wouldn't be a danger. It would actually be a benefit to the Americans. Yes. Does the American not want a pro-American ally in the region? Sure, that's a check. Do they not want a pro-Western ally? That's a check. Do they not want American soldiers and military personnel to be safe in the Middle East? That's a check. We have to remember, not one American soldier lost his life in Iraqi Kurdistan during the entire 2003 Iraq War.
Wow.
To this day. And so these are all checks. You want to be in the Middle East. You want to be in a strategic part of the Middle East. That's in Kurdistan. Do you want to maximize pressure, as John Bolton has said, or Secretary Pompeo, or even the president, on Iran? That's the Kurds. We are a buffer to this land bridge, if you will, that they're trying to create. It's,
right.
The solution always ends up coming back to the Kurds.
Tillman, this past weekend, we've seen evidence that apparently it's been a tough slog completing the capture of the last bastion for ISIS in eastern Syria at Aqaz. And interestingly enough, the dead enders among the ISIS fighters are asking for something that has occurred before, to be bussed out, essentially, to Idlib province under the purview of Erdogan. What does that say?
Basically, that says what the Kurds have been saying all along, is that Erdogan's biggest threat is not ISIS. Erdogan would rather have a Islamic State rather than a Kurdish state. That unfortunately, the Americans need to look at Erdogan through a different lens. This is not your friendly NATO ally that you're used to. This is not the same Turkey that wants to be part of the European Union. This is much different. They've changed their foreign policy. They've shifted towards the East. And it's time for the United States to realize this and pick their allies, you know, for what it is. And that's not, doesn't look like that's Turkey any longer, but that's the Kurds. And Erdogan is protecting a major Al-Qaeda hub in Idlib province. It's under his control. And the fear is that he will use these forces to go across the river east of the Euphrates River to attack the Syrian Democratic Forces.
Speaking of Syrian Democratic Forces, how large is this force? I mean, what's the power behind its numbers, and what have they accomplished?
Right. The Syrian Democratic Forces is composed of 60,000 local troops. That's pretty huge. And that has been the most solid, organized, and disciplined troop fighters on the ground in Syria, especially east of Syria. And they've accomplished tremendous, tremendous successes. They've liberated Raqqa, for example. That's ISIS's former ISIS capital. They've taken over large swaths of the Euphrates River from ISIS and Assad regime and the Shiite-backed militias. They control large the majority of the oil fields in the northeast Syria. Majority of the oil fields, about 80 to 90% of the oil inside Syria, is under the control of the Syrian Democratic Forces.
And they've done this without heavy armor and artillery then.
Exactly.
Oh,
and they've done this without modern weapons. And yes, the U.S. is supplying them with the airstrikes
and what they need.
And they're very much helpful with that. But they need modern weapons to sustain. Remember, they're fighting another non-state actor.
Right.
But the biggest fear is Iran from the south across the river and Turkey from the north.
Wow. We have one minute, Gary. We have one minute, so.
Getting back to Erdogan, he's proposing Turkish control of a safe zone in Syria from the Mediterranean to the Iraqi Kurdish frontier. How dangerous is that?
It's very dangerous. If Turkey wants a safe zone or a buffer zone, however he wants to call it, it should be inside Turkey, not inside Syria. We know Turkey's history. Once Turkey grabs a piece of land, it won't give it back. It's about annexation for Turkey. They have this neo-Ottomanism agenda. You know, they feel that they have lost after the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the end of World War I, and they want to expand their territory. Afrin is an example. Let's look at even further back. Cyprus, 1974. Mm-hmm. Have they returned that? No. And northeast Syria, that buffer zone is very dangerous because it covers 7 or 8, I believe, major Kurdish cities. A majority of the Kurdish population is in the north.
We also know that if they can get a chance to grab oil land, they're going to do that as well. So that's a very good point. We've come to the end of this first segment, so stay tuned. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix. Here on Israel News Talk Radio.
We are sponsored by Torah Learning Channel at TorahLearningChannel.com, found on the internet and on YouTube. So make sure that you take time to check out some of the best Torah teaching in the world, all in one place, some of the best rabbis that you could ever imagine. We have with us right now Dilman, very special guest, part of the Middle East Truth Kurdistan Project. Very happy that you've joined us today. Jerry, I'm going to knock it over to you and let you ask the next set of questions.
Before the break, we talked about how dangerous Erdogan's interests are in northeastern Syria. But we've also had the horrible example of essentially his incursion in Jarablus first and then in Afrin, an ancient Kurdish enclave in northwestern Syria. How much of a threat has that been in terms of ethnic cleansing and the danger to the 4 million people in northeast Syria under Kurdish control?
Great question. Afrin is an example of what could happen if Erdogan is allowed to invade northeast Syria. Literally perfect example, because what we've seen in Afrin since January, since the invasion started, is ethnic cleansing, is demographic change, it's Islamization, it's Turkification, if you will. I mean, if you look at photos and videos, you see that they're flying Turkish flags, not Syrian flags or the Syrian revolutionary flags. They're bringing in, as you mentioned, they're bringing in Arab refugees or Arabs that are not indigenous to that region. This is direct conflict with the Kurds, with the local Kurds, because Afrin is a majority Kurdish city. It always has been. And aside from that, Afrin has been culturally erased. They have taken over major landmarks and statues. They have taken over agricultural fields. Erdogan has sold Afrin olive oil in the European markets, for example. This is basically ethnic cleansing against the Kurds, and we don't want this to occur in northeast Syria.
You mentioned earlier that you and your family had escaped during the first Gulf War, and of course my partner was involved with that. But that was as a result of that, when the U.S. pulled out, Saddam Hussein's forces came back in, and there was a horrible rampage essentially in Iraqi Kurdistan, but it was also triggering the establishment of a no-fly zone. How successful was that?
Very successful. I mean, look at what the Kurdistan regional government has been able to accomplish since 1992, since the no-fly zone has been implemented. It's been the safest region in Iraq since then, actually, since 1992, and especially from 2003 to present times. And we have an opportunity, America has an opportunity, this administration has an opportunity to create something very similar in northeast Syria through a no-fly zone. And this could be done. Let's take the lessons we learned from 1992. It was without U.S. troops on the ground. As you mentioned, the U.S. boots withdrew. So it was in coordination with the French. It was in coordination with the British that we were able to accomplish this. And we could replicate this, as I've written many times. We could replicate this in northeast Syria without boots on the ground. But the issue is that, okay, no problem. The United States wants to withdraw its troops, but there are willing European states that want to keep their troops on the ground. So they're in a much better position than the Kurds of Iraq were compared to the Kurds in northeast Syria.
So let me just ask you, while we're on this, what percentage of your proposal is based on this no-fly zone? What do you think? I mean, is that like the major component of it?
That's the major component of it. But as well, we have to acknowledge that the SDF exists. The Iraqi Kurds didn't have a united force,
right,
or Peshmerga force then. We have 60,000 troops that are representative of the local population. It's composed of Arabs, and it's composed of Muslims and Christians, mm-hmm. and whatnot. And they also have a self-administering government. So we have the building blocks of a self-governing system there. We just have to protect them from the air. That's what they're missing.
Gotcha.
There's been a recent interview with one of the SDF commanders, General Abdi by name, in which he says that basically he would like a mixed force on the ground of somewhere in the vicinity of about 1,500 troops, composed of essentially French, British, and U.S. troops. Is that even feasible?
I think that's doable. If the president doesn't want to keep 2,000 whole troops there, he could keep special forces inside Syria. Mm-hmm. He could keep 500 troops in Syria, and that will keep away Iran from crossing the Euphrates. That will keep Assad at bay, and that will prevent Turkey from invading from the north. Because remember, these are NATO partners. Willing partners are the British, the French, and even Australia has stated that they're willing to keep troops there to protect the SDF and Syrian Democratic Council. So a mix of not only U.S. troops is actually, it benefits the president's promises that, you know, other countries are should do more of their part as well.
How does this, let me ask you something real quick, just for a personal perspective. How optimistic do you feel now, Dilman, about where you're at as far as protection for the Kurds, period?
Since the president's tweet, I feel a little better about this.
Okay.
Largely because there's a better understanding on the Hill. We saw the outcome of both the Democrats and the Republicans. Mm-hmm. They both called for keeping troops there. What the president did essentially is he basically united both sides in keeping U.S. troops there, because we saw what happened in 2011. Mm-hmm. We know that ISIS is not defeated. We know that there's 20,000 to 30,000 fighters there. This basically brought up on the table the need to protect the Kurds,
right?
Because we can't abandon our allies. We can't abandon our partners. The Kurds have sacrificed over 10,000, not just the Kurds, but also other minorities within the SDF have sacrificed nearly 10,000 lives.
Wow.
This needs to be acknowledged. This is in Syria only. In Iraqi Kurdistan, the Peshmerga forces sacrificed nearly 2,000 forces. So, I mean, we can't just abandon them. We can't hand back Syria to Assad. That doesn't make sense. And Russia is very pleased about this call.
Good. Jerry?
Having said that, what do you think the Russians' intent is for, say, an area that is basically controlled by the Kurds with Western allies?
Russia is very much against this because he has stuck with his partner, Bashar Assad. He wants him to retake over all of Syria, every inch, as Assad has stated many times. But also, he is against a Turkish buffer zone as well. So what Russia is trying to do first is to create a wedge between NATO partners, between Turkey and the United States.
Right.
And Erdogan is unfortunately taking this bait. We know this with the S-400 missile purchases. And he's just restated, actually, just a few days ago that he's not backing off on this purchase. The missiles are supposed to be delivered July 2019. But Russia's ultimate intent is to give back Assad all of Syrian territory. He can continue to be the major power in the Middle East as the U.S. Decides to gradually withdraw from the Middle East, which is very dangerous. This is an opportunity for the United States to stay in Syria. I mean, why wouldn't you stay in Syria when you control majority of the oil fields, and it's under your partner's control? Why wouldn't you stay in Syria when it keeps Iran at bay? Why wouldn't you stay in Syria when it keeps Turkey at check, and you don't have to rely on Incirlik military base any longer to that degree?
One would think that the Russians would be much more happier with a NATO zone than a Turkish zone, but he's not wanting either one, I guess.
He's not wanting either one. Russia would not want a NATO partner there. Against his interest. And Putin could care less about, you know, the civilian population and whatnot.
Right.
But the United States is not Russia. The United States has an obligation to protect civilians, and Russia does not have an obligation to protect civilians. We witnessed this in Afrin, Jerry mentioned earlier. In January 2018, Russia and Putin and Assad basically asked the Kurds, either you allow the Assad regime to come in and take over Afrin, we'll control it, we won't allow Turkey to come in, or you will allow Turkey to invade and we'll pull out our troops and give them the green light.
Mm-hmm.
The Kurds said, how can we give you Afrin? Afrin is our territory, and plus it's been the most peaceful region before this invasion since the entirety of the Syrian civil war.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the Kurds declined Putin's offer, and the very next day, January 19th, Erdogan got the green light, and the invasion started on Operation Olive Branch.
Wow, so that was the precipitation before
exactly.
Before the I didn't know that. That's news here. We have about let's see, probably about a minute left. Jerry, do you want to ask one last question, and then we go into the break and come back and address it?
It is related to Incirlik.
Okay.
We understand from guests on our program that, in fact, well over a dozen tactical airfields have been established in the northeastern area of Syria underneath the control of the Kurds. Is that a backup, essentially, for a no-fly zone?
You want me to answer after? Or?
Well, I tell you what, we're going to go to a break, and then you can answer after the break. Just want to remind you, the listener, that we are sponsored by TorahLearningChannel.com. It's found on the internet, and we understand that Torah Learning Channel is also available for those in the United States on Amazon and Roku devices as well. You can just download the app and watch it for free. And the Torah Learning Channel is very appreciative of all those who make it such a great success. Check it out on the internet, TorahLearningChannel.com. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking to Dilmun Abdulkader there, and we are very excited about the news that he's bringing us. So don't go away. We'll be right back after these.
Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
We're back from the break. Thank you so much. We've been talking about Syria, the Kurds, the Kurdish resistance, the pullout, all things above. We have Dilmun Abdulkader, and we are going to knock it back over to Jerry for his question we asked right before the break.
Dilmun, what is essentially the logistical support for the operations of a no-fly zone of the type that you're talking about, and we've heard had been done before in the first Gulf War in terms of what to do in northeast Syria?
Right. So as far as implementing a no-fly zone or enforcing a no-fly zone requires nearby air bases or in nearby military bases on the United States part. The U.S. can do this. We have 5,500 U.S. troops, first of all, in Iraq. The president just visited them in December.
Mm-hmm.
And they are in Al-Asad Air Base Field. This is along the border. It's just right next door. We have a air base in Jordan, which we even under the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, we even gave them more funds, actually, over $1 billion. To invest in that base, and we've been using that airfield since 2014 in Operation Inherent Resolve to fight the fight against ISIS. We have also air bases in Kuwait and the rest of the region, as you know, in Qatar as well. So all these can be used to enforce this no-fly zone to protect the Kurds of northeast Syria, and also this lessens the reliance on Incirlik military base in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Because we kind of have this perspective that Turkey is too big to fail. We need this. We need Incirlik military base. Well, we have to keep in mind Turkey hasn't been very friendly to us regarding Incirlik. They've actually been giving us problems. Germany realized this in 2017 as their troops pulled out of Incirlik altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually moved and transitioned to Jordan, a military base in Jordan. So Germany has realized this, that Turkey is just becoming a problem, but the United States has to catch up.
What is the Israeli stake in freedom for the Kurds at this point?
With the Israelis, we all know that they don't have many friends in the region. The Kurds have always been friendly and open to the Jews and the Israelis altogether. But the issue with the Israelis is, I would say, a more of a double-edged sword, if discussed publicly. Largely because we saw this in with the Israeli support during the Iraqi Kurdish referendum in 2017. Prime Minister Netanyahu came out and supported them. But what happened in response to that, and we saw Israeli flags flying in the capital, Erbil, the Kurdish capital in Erbil. The response to that was a Shiite threat saying that we will not allow a second Israel to be created in the Middle East, especially in that region. As far as Syria, it is in the interest of Israel to have a Kurdish-led self-administration government in an autonomous region because that gives them another friendly ally. But the Kurds also have to be careful because they have to realize this, the reality of the situation. Across the river is Iran. Across the river is the Assad regime. Up to the north is Erdogan, who is not also friendly to Israel. So unless the United States can guarantee their safety, unless the United States can guarantee the Kurds a protection, not just for now and 5 or 10 years later, but, you know, forever, essentially, they will easily come out and protect the state of Israel and be friendly towards the Jews.
So in reality, you know, if we can help establish a safe zone, a safe area for Kurdish self-rule, we're actually bringing a tremendous amount of security to the region.
You are. This is definitely the idea behind it. The Kurds have always been have had the most success as far as security. We protected the Christians are running towards the Kurds for protection. The minorities in the Middle East are being protected. Their churches are being rebuilt. Even Muslims are converting to Christianity under the Kurdish protection without any fear. So this is what the Kurds in Syria have created and what the Kurds in Iraq have created throughout the years is an example of what the Middle East could be. And we should take advantage of that because, you know, the Kurds are essentially giving what the United States has been advocating for throughout the years, democracy in the region. But the United States just has to take another step of acknowledging this reality.
Right.
See, there.
Jerry, go ahead.
Gentlemen, how representative is the Syrian Democratic Council for the northeast region in Syria?
It's very representative, actually. That's the great thing. That's why it's worked, and that's why it's been successful, because it's composed of not just only Kurds. Yes, Kurds are the majority, but also of Arab indigenous populations. It's composed of Christians. It's composed of even Syriacs. Syriacs have been persecuted. They weren't able to practice their language. Syriac is the ancient Christian language. They weren't able to speak it under the Assad regime, under the Ba'athist Nationalist Party. And so that's the main key for the SDF to work and the self-governing system to work is to continue this pluralism, if you will, of all the components of Syria. And what the Kurds have created under the SDF and under the Syrian Democratic Council is far better than the alternative, which is the Assad regime in Syria, and which is Iran, the Islamic regime, which is the shifting of the Islamism of Erdogan in Turkey. So there's not one example of women being recognized as equals. We know that the co-chair of the Syrian Democratic Council was just in D.C. recently. This is a woman being represented. And she is we don't see this in the Middle East. And this is just something that we should continue for and advocate for.
Real quick, I need to ask you this, and it's not on our list of questions, but how much does the Kurdish, I guess, culture, and when I say that, I realize there are three different regions of Kurdish people. But how much of the culture or the mindset or the philosophy of the Kurds has to do with their sort of their moral position in the world about wanting equality amongst religions and sort of a plurality of work together? Is that representative of the Kurdish people, period, for centuries? What has it been?
Right. So the Kurds are, that's what they're known for. They're very secular, open-minded, pro-West, largely because they have been attacked from the surrounding states for a century, and even beyond that, actually. So the Kurds have always, they are in that four regions, actually, including Iran.
Right.
And so they understand, they've been on the other side. Mm-hmm. So they've been attacked. Their religion has been persecuted against. They are a majority Muslims, but Kurds weren't always Muslim as well. So we have to acknowledge that too. But though the Kurds want to be the protector of the minorities, because we are minorities within these larger states, and we understand being having genocide committed against us. We understand of living in refugee camps for long periods of time, and our language erased, our culture, our dress erased. So I think the Kurds are a perfect example of what the Middle East could be and the possibilities there are.
You know, during the break, I asked you who came up with the brilliant acronym for the organization MET, and those who are our Hebrew speaking audience would know right away it means truth. Was that on purpose, or was it completely happenstance event?
That's all thanks to the founder and president of MET, Sarah Stern. I didn't come up with that. I don't speak Hebrew, but I do know it does mean the truth, and it works out, right?
It does.
For Middle East truth. And that's what we do on the Hill. We tell the truth, and advocating for the Kurds, educating lawmakers on the Kurds is a prime example of MET.
Jerry, you want to ask the last question?
Speaking about advocacy on the Hill, what has been the sense of your encounters with members of Congress about support for these proposals that we've talked about during this program, and how much of that is being filtered through to the White House?
I would say that the understanding to protect the Kurds is much stronger than it was before. I would say that a no-fly zone is much more difficult to push for. However, it is being discussed. Leaving troops or gradually withdrawing U.S. troops is probably much more successful. I would say it's probably the most likely outcome rather than a no-fly zone, unless the United States the administration fully endorses this. But as far as Capitol Hill, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle do understand that the ultimate goal is to protect the Kurds, is to protect our partners, because they have, as mentioned before, they have sacrificed, and we can't just abandon our allies, because this the world is watching, and we realize that if it wasn't for the Kurds, ISIS would be elsewhere, not just in the Middle East.
Is there a website that individuals can go to and look to keep informed of what's going on in the region and with MET itself?
Yes, definitely. Our own website, metonline.org. I publish articles all the time, actually, and we do fact sheets on the ground. We do fact sheets on each conflict and each region and each country as well. So it's not just focused on Israel or the United States or, say, the Kurds, but, you know, all around from Yemen and Saudi Arabia to Iran and whatnot.
And so I can assume also that you have a contact page. Someone could write information and ask questions from the website itself. We really appreciate you coming onto the show. It's your focus is very encouraging. I really appreciate the fact that there is somebody there beating down the doors of Congress trying to get some attention. And it's a bit of comfort for us. And we hope that you're not a stranger to Beyond the Matrix. You'll come back and we'll have some further discussions in the future about what goes on in the region. Jerry, you want to wrap it up?
Well, I think what we've heard on this particular interview with Dilmun Abdelkadir is that there is hope. There is light out there in the context of furthering the Kurdish cause and also developing an important ally for American and Israeli security in the Middle East.
And you can help us by sharing this program with as many people you can so that we can inform the public. You've been listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. We're going to say shalom for now.